Okay, guys, a quick heads up. This episode had severe audio issues during recording. We've done our best to clean it up, but understand that the quality may not be up to scratch in certain places. We apologize for the inconvenience, and we'll make sure it doesn't happen again. Now, enjoy the episode.
Welcome back to a brand new episode of Two Please. I'm your host, Abhin. Once again, joined by my co-host, Rohit. How's it going, my friend?
All good. It's just really hot in Bangalore this past week. But also, the day ends in torrential rain. So, you know, it's just, I don't know how to feel about Bangalore right now. Other than that,
it gets weirdly humid after also. It's one of those annoying things. Because it's cool during the rain, but after that, it's very annoying.
Yeah. Also, speaking of hot, we have a guest in the house. this is not our first time getting Omi, our friend Omkar, on the podcast. He's been with us earlier when we were discussing the Shureverse or the Michael Shure universe. Omkar is an old friend. I have lost track. How old? I think, 14 years at this point? Well, 14
no,
years.
More than that.
Since we've known him. And he's a podcaster extraordinaire, a fellow pop culture enjoyer, and general Accra Ghana celebrity. Anyway, that aside, why have we called Omkar on this specific episode of it?
Well, to be perfectly honest, we were discussing what episode to do next, like we always do after recording the previous one. And as you were running through the list of entries or different films that we wanted to take a look at, we stumbled onto The Matrix, and we've known Omkar for so long. I've known him for at least more than a decade at this point. And the one thing that I clearly know about Omi is that he loves The Matrix. And it would be criminal, in our opinion, to have done this episode without him. So we're like, you know what? Let's give Omkar a call. And within like an hour, he had confirmed, he had set the time. We couldn't make the time work. This episode was supposed to be recorded a week prior. But within an hour, he'd set up everything ready to go because he was really into it. And I'm so glad because I honestly don't know how we could do this episode without him.
Yeah. Also, I'm like kind of relieved because between Abhin and Omkar, I think I'll chip in as and when necessary. I'm going to let Omkar take point on this episode. Also, it's breakfast time in Ghana, which is why Omkar is regaling us with his.
I mean, it's a Sunday, so like, you know, late breakfast.
Yeah.
I've never heard anyone eat noodles for breakfast, Omi, if I'm being honest.
That's me, dude.
That doesn't do what the rest is, what everyone else does, right?
Yeah, dude.
He's already breaking pathways for
Okay, with that, let's start the show.
Unfortunately, no one can be told what the Matrix is. You have to see it for yourself.
So before we get into the episode, let's quickly discuss very briefly what the Matrix is about. The Matrix is about this dude called Thomas Anderson, who has a day job as some sort of an office engineer. And then at night, he moonlights as this hacker dude called Neo. And then one day, he's kidnapped by a bunch of agents, or rather like he's captured by a bunch of agents, but then he thinks it turns out to be a dream. But then again, he gets kidnapped by a different set of individuals who tell him that he's part of a simulation, that the real world that humans know has been taken over by AI, and that you're all living in little pods inside the simulated world called the Matrix.
But basically, man finds out he's in a simulated world, is told he's the chosen one, and he has to break free from it. Pretty much like that, yeah. And then obviously a lot of overarching themes.
I think the bare bones plot doesn't do the movie as much justice because Matrix is a lot more than about just the plot, right? It's about, like Omi said, the themes and the larger ideas that really keep you thinking far after you've finished watching the movie. But good, I mean, we've sort of done plot summary before first impressions, but I think, you know, now that we've set context as for the two people in our listener base who haven't watched The Matrix, now they know what we're going to talk about.
Exactly.
But then Omkar, what was your first what were your first impressions when you watched
it? I watched the movie. So I think I was like, 9 years old. We had got like this home theater system and new DVD player. It's like back then, Sony home theater system with like 5 speakers and all that. And we had bought like a bunch of DVDs where like Charlie's Angels. Then it must have been 2000 because Charlie's Angels came out in 2000. But it was like Charlie's Angels. We had like Matrix. We had so many of these movies, right? And I remember the Matrix, they just put it on and I was blown away. I was like, what? Fuck, I didn't understand jack shit in the movie. You know, like the scene, like this movie starts with them, like the police are there, they're trying to like get Carrie Ann Moss, Trinity, you know, like step away from the laptop, and then she goes, and then they cut to the scene down, and then Smith is there, and then they're like, you know, we've sent some couple of officers, and Smith is like, you know, no officer, your men are already dead, and then it changes to then, and she like jumps, and there's full like 180 kind of like rotation, and she kicks the guys. I was like, wow! And then from then, like the movie was just like one like amazing stunt after the other, and I never understood the movie. I should just watch it purely for the stunts. Finally, my dad had to explain that, you know, these are humans. They're used as batteries to generate this AI world and, you know, blah, blah, blah. But yeah, like, that was my first time watching it, and such a memorable, like, viewing that was, because I was like, what the fuck? Whoa, they can dodge bullets. Yeah.
What about you, Abhi?
Well, I mean, the first time I watched The Matrix, I was blown away. You know, I wasn't, forget watching The Matrix. The first time you saw the trailers, you were blown away because you'd never seen anything like this. Because from the trailers, it's the one thing that really stood out, obviously, is Omi mentioned the Carrie Ann Moss Trinity jump that and the 360 camera turn. Then you had bullet time. Now, I didn't know it was called bullet time. Then it was the first time you actually saw slow-mo in a film where it wasn't choppy. I was already had my hype levels were already at a certain level when I watched the film. And then when I watched the film, I was like, damn, this is such a great time. Now, in the years that have followed, I have seen every entry in the franchise, and I have chosen to regard The Matrix as the standalone action film. It's a super fun ride. Don't take it too seriously, and just like I did, because I had, like, much like Omi, I had no idea what AI was and what the humans. And I mean, I understood the plot, but I wasn't really paying attention. It's not what I had gone into the movie to watch.
Okay, so my story is a little out of left field, right? So I didn't watch it around the time it had released. I watched it a little later. Before engineering. So before I got into the quiz scene and all that, I think probably around 2006 or 7 is when I had watched it. The problem was I had watched another movie before this, which was Jaani Dushman. So I had watched Jaani Dushman first. I'm like, whoa, Matrix is copying Jaani Dushman. And then I saw, oh, it's 1999. Sorry, it's the other way around.
Wait, what does Jaani Dushman copy in Matrix?
No, so the whole bullet dodging scene is there in Jaani Dushman. Then there is a scene of Terminator 2 also where this guy melts down and becomes that mercury liquid and then reforms.
Like, I didn't mean to watch
Jaani Dushman. Wow, even Terminator 2 is copying from Jaani Dushman. But, so, I mean, you know, that bizarre introduction to Matrix apart. It was also around the time when I had started getting into science fiction as a genre to read a lot. And like, I would say around the time I was 15, 16 was when I really dove into Arthur C. Clarke and just general sci-fi reading. And I really got into, that's around the first time I watched Blade Runner as well. So, this is a different flavor of sci-fi, right? It's cyberpunk is, I would say, a subgenre. It's not the flavor of sci-fi that I like. So, I probably don't dislike the movie. I understand the importance of the movie, but I don't probably like it as much as you both. So I'm probably not going to be as ecstatic a voice on this pod. I said on the WhatsApp group, I'm going to bring some of the criticism.
Yeah,
I have some point, but I'm sure. By and large, yes, it is a great movie. It's a very important movie in the sci-fi genre. There is no debating.
I think for how you feel about Matrix is how I feel about Blade Runner. Because Blade Runner also definitely has an influence on this movie, like the aesthetic and the whole. And I watched Blade Runner and I was like, I understand why people, Blade Runner. But like, maybe because I watched Matrix at my age, I was like, OK, I get Matrix, Blade Runner, important movies, 80s map, you know, the things that were not happening and like stuff like that. Yeah.
I think Matrix is a more, I mean, it's a better packaged film in terms of like Blade Runner is not everyone's cup of tea because it's narrative is slow burn.
Absolutely.
And I say this as a fan of the original and the sequel, which we have waxed lyrical about in the previous episode. But what really worked for me in this film was that I don't think for a second you're bored. I mean, yes, there's a bit in the middle where there's some exposition that happens. And I've watched this film in preparation for this episode, so the memory of it is still fresh. And there is a bit in the middle when they're on the ship and they're having conversations about what the Matrix is and who these characters are, so you care for them. But barring that, I don't think this film stops. It is beautifully paced. It doesn't wait for you to understand the film. It says, okay, you might not understand the movie, and there's a story behind we'll get to it in the BTS section. But the way it's packaged, it's that it just keeps going. You're like, fine, okay, the story will make sense eventually, but oh my God, what the fuck are these visuals? And everything is so well done. And it's a very weird time, right? Because the 90s action hero was not the 80s action hero, and he's certainly not the action hero of today. I think the 80s action hero was a bulky dude. The 90s action hero was more efficient. Like, he didn't have to look like the all-encompassing action hero. And I think Keanu Reeves really encapsulates that character, especially in the time this movie came out. So you really believe that this dude is capable of everything.
Which is also, I mean, I'm going to be covering this when we get to the theme section, which is also because I feel this movie sort of predicts the rise of tech giants, right? Where the techies are the powerful ones. It presages the world we see today, where all of your billionaires are tech billionaires. You think 90s, maybe subconsciously, it was also channeling that feeling that, you know, tech was becoming a bigger part of everyone's lives, and being a nerd was slowly becoming cooler than it was probably in the 80s.
Yeah.
BTS stories, what do we have? Facts, trivia, any interesting things?
Have you guys seen Awara Pagal Deewana?
Fuck yes, I know where this is going.
Awara Pagal Deewana is one of my favorite Hindi movies of all time. It's also a copy of, I think, The Whole Nine Yards. Either that or one of like the Deewana Pagal, one of them is a ripoff of some other movie. It was Awara Pagal, The Whole Nine Yards, the whole dental thing, and he's a hitman and all that. So in that, Akshay Kumar plays Guru Gulab Khatri, right? He's like this some famous assassin, mafia guy, whatever. So you know there's that scene in Matrix where him and Trinity enter. They're going to rescue Morpheus. So they enter through the security and he's like, do you have any chains, keys? Well, and then he opens his jacket and he's like, holy shit. And he starts shooting. And it's called the lobby scene, right? Because it's in the lobby of the band. They have a big gunfight. And Awara Pagal Deewana ripped off that entire thing, dude. Scene.
They don't have
a Trinity next to him, so Trinity stunts and Neo stunts Akshay Kumar only does. Like epic, dude. And then you remove his mask.
Isn't there a mask? There's a mask reveal at the end.
Yes, he's trying to frame Akshay Kumar's character, and he removes the mask, and it's oh my god.
Yeah, Rahul Dev.
Correct. Yeah, so that is my. That is my BTS
too. But Johnny Lever character, Rail Ki Patri, Chota Chhatri.
But okay, coming to the making of the film, the Wachowskis at this point had done one movie called Bound, which is like this indie darling, and they were writing The Matrix at the time, and they took it to I think this is produced by New Line, right? Barry M. Osborne
and Warner Brothers.
They were like, we don't understand it, but we like your vision. They hired this guy to storyboard, and he did 600 storyboards. And the moment they saw the storyboards, they greenlit the film. They shot it in Sydney as opposed to shooting it in America because they could shoot it for a cheaper budget. This movie's budget was $60 million, which is mind-boggling given the shit shows that I've made for maybe five times the price today. And if they shot it in America, the budget would have ballooned to $120 million. This, I think, is probably the most popular BTS, is who they wanted to cast as Neo. They were looking to cast Will Smith as Neo, and Will Smith famously said no, because he said the Wachowskis came to him and they had these like storyboards, and they said, oh, we're going to do this, we're going to invent something called bullet time, it's never been seen before, and he just didn't get it.
But he later even came to say that, you know, it's good that he wasn't cast, because he doesn't feel he would have done justice to the character of Neo then. Like, when, like, no, in hindsight, he Keanu was like...
In hindsight, I mean, he's got that awareness.
I know, he said it out loud. If the story is like, he said the Wachowski came and they were just like, you know, we're going to be jumping over Black Jupiter and whoa. And he was like, what the fuck is this? Like, how do you describe a movie to me? Like, but it's, you can't describe it, right? Like, it's hard to, like... Yeah, hard, so he was just like, you know, and then he did Wild Wild West.
No, Will Smith on Django, apparently the reason he rejected the movie was him and Tarantino had creative differences, where when Tarantino narrated the story to him, Will Smith said, this should be a love story about the main Django going back to rescue his wife. I think, look who you're talking to. You think Tarantino's going to make a love story? What the fuck is wrong with
him? It is a sort of a love story.
It is a love story.
I mean, he wanted it to be like, you know, feel good, pursuit of happiness type love story, you know, against all odds, he's rescuing his wife, the whole revenge angle out of the window. Like, bro, there is going to be bloodshed. There are going to be people shot to a pulp. It's a Tarantino movie. Get with the program. I think all of the movies, all of the roles he's passed up, he's done the cinematic world a favor. You know, the replacement has always been better suited for it.
I think because if if Will Smith had been Neo, Morpheus would have gone to somebody else. I put the name up, the picture on the screen. I don't remember who it is, but I know that that's what was happening. And as a result, Lawrence Fishburne took it. Now, Lawrence Fishburne also has famously passed on Quentin Tarantino roles in the past. The most egregious one being Jules Winfield in Pulp Fiction. It was written for him.
It
was written for him, and then... he said no, and Samuel L. Jackson took it, and the rest is history, right? So, but I think, yeah, Lawrence Fishburne in this film is great. And so is Carrie Ann Moss. I think possibly career-defining performance for Carrie Ann Moss. Not be the case for Keanu Reeves, given the man's repertoire of films. I think for each decade, maybe the 2000s was when he kind of was going through a lot of personal shit in life, so it was, he put acting on the back burner or didn't do a lot of films. But for two decades of his life, this man's filmography is just insane. Because even if The Matrix didn't happen, Speed is always there.
Box office guy.
Yeah, like he is, even The Devil's Advocate, which is a really silly film, but I kind of like it. It's kind of camp and it's fun. There are a lot of...
Keanu Reeves in Francis Ford Coppola's Dracula is...
Yes.
It's terribly good. He's like, he's so bad he's good. His British accent... He was in Carfax. I mean, why are you saying Carfax, man?
Jonathan, what is it?
It's just a man himself. Look, he's growing young.
What's my wife Keanu Reeves attempting a British accent? He's horrible at it, right?
That film is good fun. I enjoy it. It's possibly the definitive Dracula film, even though it's a little weird.
Dracula is my favorite fiction novel. If you call that the definitive Dracula film, then I'm going to come home and hit you.
It's close by.
You'll be one road away. It'll be very
fine.
Anyway, we move to BTS or other movies. Let's come back to Matrix.
Coming back to The Matrix, yeah. Then what else happened in this film? So there was shot in Sydney.
Was
then...
this the one where he gave everyone a motorcycle?
That was the second one where he gave the 9 stuntmen the motorbikes, the Harley Davidson bikes.
I think this is when stories of his generosity on set started coming out. I think you could see that, you know, this is a guy who
Correct.
That was the other thing I recall about the whole Matrix series at large, if not the first movie. It's like, this is where the whole good guy Keanu meme found its initial legs.
Speaking of stuntmen, as I was watching the credits yesterday, Chad Stahelski's names pop up, and his name pops up, and I was like, "Oh yes, of course! How could I have forgotten?" Because Chad Stahelski was Keanu Reeves' stuntman, who then went on to become a director, famously one of two directors who did the John Wick film, and he's been doing I think the fourth one is him.
There's a TV show, no? The Continental.
The Continental. There's there's an Ana de Armas movie called Ballerina that's coming out, set in the same universe. So, I was like, oh yeah, shit, of course, how could I have forgotten? So I think another interesting bit of trivia is that in the film, they kind of, like all the sunglasses were handmade by this company called Blind. There were a bunch of companies vying for that contract, but they found this dude called, from a company called Blind, and he was brought onto the set and he was hand making these sunglasses on set. So, which is why they're also iconic. And like, this is peak 90s, right? Wraparound shades, the Morpheus, frameless ones.
I have a hot take here that Morpheus shades are fucking moronic, dude. It's a hot take. I don't know. You don't have to agree with me. It looks fucking lame. I watched the movie yesterday for the episode. I just looked at Morpheus. I'm like, you look like a clown, dude. What are you doing? The other ones are, I can excuse them, right? They're era specific. Mm. Late 90s and cyberpunk grunge. It fits. The Morpheus one, I'm just like, bro, what?
Yeah, fair enough.
You look like Mr. Monopoly or two monocles. One more piece of trivia which I just remembered. A lot of the sets for the movie were recycled from the sets of Dark City, I think, which was a 1997 or 98.
Yes,
DMV.
They were. Liam Neeson. He's not
nice.
No. Dark City is. Liam Neeson is Dark Man.
It's somebody.
Dark City. Rupert Sewell and Jennifer Connelly. Yeah.
Alex Vargas, not the guy who made The Crow.
Alex Royals.
I think Kiefer Sutherland is in Dark City.
Yeah, Kiefer Sutherland, Rufus Sewell, Jennifer Connelly. Sorry, that's Dark Man. My bad. Mm. But Dark City's sets were reused for Matrix. I remember that being a recurrent quiz question as well. But okay. Any other stories or should we dive into memorable moments?
Before we do that, I'll just dive in. Shout out the anime influences in this film.
Mm-hmm.
So, before the anime influences, there is a book called Simulacra.
Simulation.
Yes, so yeah. That plays a huge part. That was given to the actors to read because it forms the basis of the story.
It's in the movie as well.
Mm.
He opens to give the discs.
Mm. And it's about symbols not representing things that they shouldn't be, which is like how the Matrix is. And the anime influences, one can argue is almost a ripoff of Ghost in the Shell. Because Ghost in the Shell standalone complex is Ghost in the Shell standalone complex is the series. Ghost in the Shell, the 1995 anime film. If you haven't seen it, I highly recommend you do. Especially if you're in the age bracket that we're in, because I've seen the movie 3 times, and on the third time I finally understood what was happening. It's very good, and it's like pure cyberpunk material. Of course, Akira being the other, which kind of has influenced most things. So yeah, that's about it. Before we move on to
actually with influences, I thought that reminded me. I wanted to sort of cover this. There's a couple of other literary movie references that are there in the Matrix. They talk about Alice in Wonderland a lot. Obviously, Follow the White Rabbit.
Yes, Follow the Rabbit,
taking it all the way to its conclusion. Cypher makes an allusion to The Wizard of Oz, where he says. Kansas go bye-bye, right? So it makes conscious allusions to prior works of literature or movies which themselves question the nature of reality. So they are sort of planting that seed in your head that, you know, question everything you see, because what you see is not what truth is. And also the famous line that Morpheus had, that welcome to the desert of the real. Line was borrowed by the philosopher Slavoj Žižek for his 2002 book, which talks about how reality has changed post 9/11. And I think the name of that book itself is also Welcome to the Desert of the Real. So
I think that's from Simulacra.
Matrix has had on the real.
That line is from Simulacra.
Oh, you're saying the line itself is from Simulacra and Simulation?
Yeah, it's from somewhere else.
And also by Žižek. Ooh. Correct. But yeah, I think that... is what we have on BTS. Let's get into memorable moments. Over to you, Omkar.
Go for it, my friend.
The whole movie is memorable. Okay, first memorable moment
was
is...
The, yeah.
First one is definitely Trinity kicking, doing that whole thing. Hmm. And so there was a thing, also you're talking about the BTS. So apparently when they went to Warner Brothers, right, they needed money for it. And Warner Brothers like, we'll give you 10 million, take it or leave it. So they said, fuck it, we'll shoot whatever we can with this 10 million and show it to these guys. And I think they did like the first, or they got some amount of money. I don't know if it's 10 million, maybe I'm not remembering actually. And they did like the first 10 minutes, which included this trending. They saw that and they were like, fuck it, take the money that you need. Like, that was like, that is what got Warner Brothers on the hook. They were obviously afraid because, you know, heavy sci-fi movie, is it going to work? Some hardcore, you know, like paint detail, but that thing. That's one. Second one, memorable moment. I think the one where his mouth closes, which was very eerie. Dude, when they're interrogating him and then they put the mole in his stomach and they close his mouth and in, you know that scene like, where it goes like body, it's like it sticks. Yeah, that was body. It's like it sticks and so it's memorable in a bad way, but it's still memorable.
It's not rewatchable, but it's memorable. Sorry, on that scene.
Like that scene.
I think I have a thing about belly buttons, right? Like, think if you just take a minute to think about belly, it's such a bizarre part of your body.
It's going to nowhere.
It's like it has serves no purpose other than like collecting dirt and sweat.
Yes,
it's a fucking weird part of your body. And they put that squeamish thing. I'm just like, bro, no, just no.
And you know that scene where he like they remove it and he's like, holy shit, that was real. Yeah. And that's like
horrible.
That definitely then the way he's like, you know, I know kung fu, and he's like, do you like show me? And then he's like that
a
fight
little more,
sequence,
a little more animation on his face would have been nice though. I know kung fu. Be excited.
I mean, it's Keanu, dude. Like, and you know, like they talk about, like, you know, his body's a machine. He's just been going through like all this kung fu, this thing. Like, I think Tank, right? Yeah. He's the younger brother, and then he's like, you know, he's like, he's just going like for hours, 14 hours nonstop. His body's a machine. He's like, I know kung fu, and then they fight, and then that scene is awesome with the music.
I think that is my favorite scene of the movie.
It starts with this like cool music, this thing, and then it becomes very serious because he's like, stop trying to hit me. And then he's like, you know, because he says, you're getting into my mind and whatnot. That scene is definitely memorable. And then they all come to watch him. And then obviously the jump, where he fails the jump because nobody gets it on the first attempt. And then he learns that anything that happens to you in the Matrix happens to you in real life, where you will get hurt. If you get in the Matrix, you'll get which else? Dude, definitely the whole lobby scene, you know, that whole sequence where he just shows the guns and that guy's like, holy shit. Then famous bullet time sequence where, you know, he goes back and like that thing took, I think, 127 cameras to do as well. Like they had to do it in a laser and it hit each this thing. So they had to get it done like very accurately as well. So it had to be done with it. Yeah, and it took like a lot of time. I think it took like 3-4 months to get that thing done just for a 20-30 second fucking shot. Like, this is that long. And she's like, I've never seen anyone move as fast as you do. And he's like, no, I could have done better.
Dude, the coolest line is at the end of that scene, right? When the agent is
going to kill him. Dodge this.
What
a
line, dude.
No, he says only human, because even though he dodges the bullets, they hit him, and then he's like, she's like, dodge this. That definitely. Then the scene when he fights, when he starts choosing to believe he's the one, because he doesn't run away from the agent, and then you're like, what's going on? And then Morpheus is like, he's beginning to believe. And then he fights him. And my favorite scene in that is when, you know, he's like on him and he's like, you know, death is inevitable. That is the sound of inevitable. And he's like, my name is because he keeps calling him Mr. Anderson, right?
Mr. Anderson.
That's what he keeps calling him Mr. Anderson, right? And he's just pissed. And credit to Hugo Weaving, who played Agent Smith. He was a very good villain. He really played that role to perfection, I think. And I mean,
the most memorable of looking down on somebody, right? Imagine if somebody is very clearly beneath you and you want to, he emanates that energy so well. So it's very easy to.
And you know, like that scene when he keeps telling him, give me the codes to Zion, and he's like, he talks about like how humans are dirt.
Yeah, that's stench.
Like, amazing line delivery, man. Throughout all the movie, I think he was.
And Hugo Weaving's voice also, it's he's got that weight to his voice, and he's dramatically trained. So, cadence, diction, all of it, he just hits it out of the park.
And I forgot that scene, dude. Also, one of my favorite scenes when they're about to go and storm the lobby, and then he's like, what do you need? And he's like, we need guns. Lots of guns. Lots and then just holes here. So they actually did a homage to it in John Wick 3, where they ask him something, and he's like, we need guns. Lots of guns.
Guns. Lots of guns.
Obviously, it's the whole Matrix franchise in that movie, anyway. Yeah. So then, like, Matrix. I remember like seeing that and I was like, hi, Matrix, you know that, Matrix. Yeah, so I guess these are like the most memorable scenes in the movie for me. Like, obviously the one where he believes and then he stops the bullets, and then, you know, like,
yeah, that's, yeah,
he fights
that's,
him with, yeah, one that's hand. Yeah, that's
that when scene he knows has a very he cool sound effect. If you've seen the part where the reality bends around him, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's just, mm-hmm. If you listen to that scene on earphones, they've done some very funky stuff with the sound. It you almost feel the bending instead of just watching it. I don't know how to describe it. When I rewatched it, I watched it on earphones.
Also, I forgot to mention the details, but I think it's very important. When they made the movie, right, they did different color gradients for the different places they were in. So in the Matrix, it has a green tint.
Mm.
In the real world, it's no tint. And in the training simulation, it's a yellow tint. No, yellow. Mm. Yellow tint.
Yeah, no, the train simulation is yellow. The real world, it's blue.
Well, it's blue. Blue, yeah, you're right.
It's blue.
It's blue. Yeah.
And the training sequence is
Matrix
yellow.
Is, green. So,
any
other memorable moments for you guys?
Okay, I'm just going to like piggyback off a few of them. Obviously, the first being the first previously spoken about the first sequence, the body horror mouth closing thing, which is also, again, I think is referenced in Revenge of the Fallen. Because they kind of send one same similar creature into Shia LaBeouf's face and like it to access information. Like a dragon thing. Yeah, so this has been I don't know what it is this week. I've been watching a bunch of horror films. I watched Event Horizon recently. I was watching The Exorcist, and again, there's some mad body horror there as well. Probably like the perpetrators of body horror. Then, so it's just. It's like it's been a weird week and reanimated.
Still,
like none of
still,
it. Compared, yeah.
Still nothing to worse than the belly button shit, dude.
No. I would say the Reanimator is worse. The Reanimator.
Yeah, I mean,
I've seen some.
Questioning Cronenberg. I'm sure Cronenberg is the king of body horror.
He definitely is.
It's that's the play, but it's not. It's a guy called Craig Gordon and Brian Yuzna.
Oh.
They're big red guys. No, it's not. It's not Cronenberg.
Oh, okay.
But anyway, so I mean, there are some real camp horror elements there, but that being, I mean, that's up there anyway. The sequence I want to talk about the Oracle thing and the spoon bending sequence.
Yes,
it's like you need to understand that it's like you are not the spoon doesn't bend, but you yourself are bending. You realize there is no spoon. And again, one of those weird moments that stand out. Then I looked at it now and it's like some reverse Sleeping Beauty nonsense. It's kind of silly now, but when he dies and she wakes him up and she says, you've always been, the Oracle told me that I would fall in love with the Chosen One. And it's like you, once,
another problem with this movie, right? You've spent so much time establishing this sci-fi universe, this is like that whole, I am forgetting the parallel I had in mind, but yeah, exactly. I'm thinking of it. You built this super nice sci-fi premise. It still makes some sense in Interstellar because they're saying love transcends space and time because it's an emotion. I can get on board with it. Here, it doesn't fit the tone of the movie at all.
Love angle between them, right?
Yeah, the whole love angle being his redemption, and you know, it's like the power of love. It's just so corny in a movie which the remaining 99% of the movie is not corny at all, right? They're so matter of fact, they're establishing roots of this universe. There's a certain logic they've taken. It's such a logic driven approach. You're like, cool, I can respect that. And you just undid that with the whole power of like, hey, yeah, don't.
you did the Sleeping Beauty Bollywood route thing, but yeah, Omi's basically covered most of the.
I want to add one more scene to this because it's a nice, memorable moment, but also something, it's a good example of another sort of semi-criticism I had of the movie, which is the scene where he meets, you know, they come to his house and we get introduced to him as a hacker at night or whatever, right? So the whole simulacra book where, I don't know, his party friends are like, why don't you come with us? And I forget the exact line he says. It's like, you remember when you, you're not sure whether you're in a dream or, you know, a dream feeds to real or
woken
up. And the guy just replies saying, yeah, it's mescaline, you should try it. And who the fuck wrote this line, dude? This movie has some really good dialogue, but it also has some really bad, like, high school level dialogue also, right? Which now, in after having seen subsequent movies and knowing what we know about the Wachowskis and the copious amount of drugs they were doing on set, you now realize, I'm guessing, a lot of things with The Matrix were like a flip of a coin, right? You either land on the side of brilliance or on the side of what the fuck, right? So,
I think there are examples of brilliance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
The second and third one was where there was more of their influence.
There was a coin, correct. So, that's what I just wanted to make that point. It has really great dialogue and it has some dialogue which is off. Also, there is a, at points, there is, I feel there's some sort of try hard, edgy. It tries a little hard to be extra edgy, right? The concept is revolutionary enough. You don't have to try that much. I don't know, maybe this is how I felt. That was the only other criticism I had, but other than that, I think I'm done with all of my criticisms. I'm on board the Matrix hype train.
So I think, is this as good a time as any to get into themes? Because I feel like we've covered basically the entire film. We've spoken about moments in across BTS and the moment section as well. So let's move quickly into theme number one. Where do we start?
Should we say man versus machine? That is basically the premise of the movie, right? That machines are using humans as batteries and, you know, they're in this simulated world and they have to break free and stuff like that. And I think it is quite true, even like Rohit said in the beginning, that it kind of predicted the future, because our reliance on like AI or like, you know, and machines has become so much now to the point where now AI has become such a big thing in 2023.
Yeah, I know. I mean, if Morpheus looks at the way AI's ChatGPT is being used today, like, there's no threat. There's this fucking noob sitting in basements generating.
I mean, we're saying there are articles about how like you take time if you have to get to some part where the AI might get sentient and all that. There's still a lot of time for it, but we're on that course. We're feeding all our possibility.
And I wouldn't say Matrix is wrong in the eventual conclusion that if AI were to actually become sentient, right? And if you were to approach human situations in a purely logical or calculative route, which any machine would take. The vision that Matrix shows us, where they're like, hey, we can use humans as a power source and make society more, efficient and all of that. Is that wrong? Because, I mean, if that's the route evolution is going to take, then that's the route evolution is going to take. It's not a wrong thing, right? We became obsolete.
Absolutely,
it's not AI's fault. So, is that a hot take to say the machines were right all along?
No, isn't even that, like, I think later on, I mean, they discuss in the sequels, I think, that if I remember correctly, like, the machines weren't bad, but then I think humans took, like, a standpoint against them. In fact, it's basically like war, and then they became like, you know, fuck it. Yes. I think something like that happens, I remember. Like, I think the third movie.
Westworld.
Discussed that. Yeah.
I feel like I keep bringing back. Like, basically, it's on Westworld. The premise of Westworld. The premise of any film, if you think about any, like, man versus machine film, is just how man was threatened, decided to exterminate iRobots. You can even accuse iRobot of doing the same thing. That was
with iRobot. Pretty much.
There you go.
Yes. I actually enjoyed that movie.
Yeah, fun too. I mean,
there's a lot of converse. There's too much converse.
I think it's man versus AI is the larger or the more obvious version of the point here. Subliminally, I think there's also the whole idea of technological overreach, right? And this movie comes out in 99. We know post 2001, post 9/11 with the Patriot Act and all in the US. Privacy went to shit, right? Nothing was private anymore. with the internet, all of your conversations are looked at. We live in a very nicely packaged surveillance state where tech companies have all of the information about us, but they make it sound so benign that we're okay with it. We're like, yeah, whatever, fucking yeah. keep our info.
Oh, personalized ads. That sounds good.
Yeah, right? So, there is the whole idea of, hey, we can't outrun these programs. Think about what they're saying, right? When they're saying the agents, they say nobody has ever beaten an agent. These are programs that we can only keep outrunning, but eventually they'll catch us. It's like talking about performance ads, dude. They will catch you. You will be served.
It's like cookies. It's like trying to find disabled me. It's like me and the cookies also. Disabled cookies. Disabled only functional cookies. One day the performance cookies will catch up.
Jokes about technological overreach is a real problem in our time today, right? So the movie does have that as a subliminal message as well, I feel.
Yeah, for sure.
The other theme that I wanted to talk about, which for me was the message that stayed with me far longer than after I finished watching the movie, is, again, this is one of those movies that questions the fundamental nature of reality, right? And in fact, if I remember, this was a phenomenon that extended outside of the movie as well. After this movie, a lot of people were like, hey, I'm in the Matrix and, this is not reality and stuff. And the way they go about describing how the Matrix is such a carefully crafted version of reality, which is ultimately fake, is very convincing. And that is what I feel you have to give this movie flowers for, is they've thought of the core concept has been given a lot of thought. If they had done a lazy job of it, you could have poked, there could have been a lot of loopholes that you could have, or holes in the theory that you could have poked, right? Like, hey, this doesn't make sense. Like, no, they've thought about it. Yeah, in the mythos of Matrix, there is a reason why this is this way or this is that way. Why did they want the Matrix to look like 1999? Why was it frozen in that point of time? Because for them, people were also, the whole Y2K fear was there around this time. And maybe they thought 1999 is going to be the pinnacle of civilization, because the moment the clock turns to 2000, a lot of things are going to go to shit. So there's a lot of thought given to this world. And obviously, any movie that questions nature of reality instantly becomes alluring to most people, because all said and done, all of us feel that there probably is a better world out there, right? We all, even somebody who has everything in life, it is human nature to feel bad about things we don't have. Everyone, all of us has some baseline level of sadness that we, it's just existential shit, right? And if someone were to tell you, hey, this is not the real world, there's something better out there, or, the truth is out there, it's very rare that somebody would just walk away from that without engaging with it, right? Which is at the core of why Matrix is such an alluring movie for... It's a very universal movie. Anyone who watches it would get drawn into, hey, this is something I can relate to. This ties into that wishful thinking of maybe there's something better out there. And as I was giving this... the whole idea some thought, I actually wanted to juxtapose the Matrix with the Black Mirror episode San Junipero, which are...
I love that episode.
Complete flipping of the coin, right? Here we're seeing there's a dystopia and people are switching into the Matrix. It's become a way to, like, it's become opium of the masses in a sense.
Yeah.
People are in the Matrix and they've forgotten how bad reality is. In San Junipero, it's the opposite, where real life is okay. It's not a dystopia, but people are willingly plugging into San Junipero because for them it's the utopia which they cannot have in everyday life, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very happy story, while the Matrix is essentially a very dystopian movie. So I was just thinking about how nature of reality can be represented both as something very negative and as something very positive.
For me, I want to talk about the negative implications it's had in real world society today. So now the Matrix has become this this hot term for a certain section of the society. I feel like we haven't even spoken about the biggest contribution of this pill to society, the red pill and the blue pill. Yeah. So if you're supposed to be, you're supposed to have a certain thought process if you're in the blue pill, for the blue, and you have a certain thought process if you're in the red pill. Now the red pill gave rise to this weird incel culture that felt that
you were being downtrodden on, and you know, your life sucked, and everything was being manipulated by the so-called Matrix, and the rise of like the Andrew Tate characters, the Sneeko characters. And then if you've been paying attention to the Red Pill community, it's a very toxic space that is currently dying. I mean, the time of recording this episode, it is dying, but it has had a significant impact on the lives of children. I think people who are, you could say, are disenfranchised, it attracts a disenfranchised. Boys, yeah, especially young boys.
It's same thing, right? You want a better reality. You're
exactly, yeah.
All of those people.
You're attracting people who cannot attract women, who can't make a lot of money, who are stuck in dead-end jobs, who aren't like unemployed, and here comes this figure that is basically making his or her money off of you, while pretending to guide you out of this world that you currently find yourself in by offering you advice that you could find for free on the internet, but they charge you a certain amount, and they essentially create a cult-like scenario, which is completely the wrong way in which you interpret the Matrix. You kind of want to, yes, there are certain institutions out there that control the narrative of how things function. If anything, this last week has been proof of that. That's not what this community is trying to do. It's just trying to drive a very straight divide of us versus them by incorporating the worst aspects of the lessons that you could possibly take from the film or from the subject matter. So it's important that we call that out, because it as much of an, like, we need to understand this. The Matrix is an action film. Don't look to the Matrix as some sort of philosophical guidebook to guide you through the rest of the world.
The problem is truth, because of Matrix and movies like this, truth has become a matter of subjective opinion. I'm like, truth is, yes, truth, guys. What do you mean?
Mm-hmm.
Facts are facts. Facts are not opinion. This whole culture that has come out of Matrix, yes, this is Matrix's unfortunate bad legacy, baggage that it has left.
Mm.
Baggage, yeah. And I'm sure like Wachowski wouldn't have thought this would have morphed into what it is today, right? But
yeah,
unfortunately, this is what we're with. That's a good point, Abin. Anything else to add on this theme, Omi? I have one more to cover up.
I think like you had mentioned what paid versus free will as well, right?
Yeah. So, which was the other one that I wanted to talk about, which is again a recurring theme throughout the movie, right? Which is Neo is supposed to be the chosen one. Yes. Okay.
Correct.
That's whole his fate angle. Yeah. And, you know, up until the point where he meets the Oracle, everyone's been telling him, you're destined to do X, you're destined to do Y, this is your destiny, your fate, blah, blah, blah. The Oracle comes in and shatters that whole train of thought, right? Where she just said,
so not the one, not the one. Some average chutia.
Yeah. Yeah, you're just Mr. Anderson. You're not yeah. Neo. So, and we as the audience are also, it's a great subversion of expectations, right? Where
shit, he's not the one.
Yeah, they're like, where is the movie going from here? And the whatever, Morpheus' capture happens, this, that, and you're like, cool, okay, so the one is not, I mean, Neo is not the one, and Morpheus is captured, what's going to happen? Wherein Neo then decides to interpret the other thing that the Oracle says, which is there's going to be a point where either you or Morpheus will have to die, and you will have to choose. And that has nothing to do with you being the one. And then it comes down to free will, right? It is a choice. It is not something that's predestined. She tells him, you have to choose. And the movie makes a very specific point, or it, you know, he makes it a point at that point to say, I choose to go save Morpheus. And Morpheus, I think it's a very nice message that the movie gives, that sure, eventually he might turn out to be the one, but that's only because he made the choice to go save Morpheus. Probably if he hadn't, the mission, whatever, their whole thing would have been over, Morpheus would have been dead. What if the rest of the Matrix series doesn't happen? Whatever followed because it wasn't fate. It was free will that predicated everything that followed, right? Which is a lovely message, I think. You know, I hate this whole things that are meant to happen, and, you know, everything happens for you. All that's bullshit, right? Things happen because people make things happen. That's what I firmly believe. And I'm really happy this movie drives that message home.
The fact that he had to come to a point where it was free will is also fate. Like, it was destined for him to, you know, like, there is that Like,
there's a recursive
I mean, obviously,
loop, right?
Yeah, it's a recursive loop. Like, yeah. If you chose and listen,
everything is deterministic. It's possible. I think in the ecosystem of the story, they do make it a point to say Neo chose.
Point, yeah, that Neo chose, yeah. Because if he hadn't, he wouldn't have died, and Anderson wouldn't have died for Neo to come out.
Correct.
Yeah,
correct.
All that, yeah.
So you're saying everything is planned.
You were saying
something. I mean, like.
We're back to Akshay Kumar.
Yeah, dude.
Everything is blind.
Oila.
Anyway, Omkar was saying something serious and Abhin just came in with us.
No, it's fine, dude. I like it. It ties down to Avara Pagal Divana because he's only Guru Club Khatri and it's blind. Destined.
All this time.
Is he not in Jani? Isn't he in Jani Dushman as well?
He's also in Jani Dushman. Oh my god.
See, it's fucking planned, dude.
But his story on Jani Dushman's story is great. Have you heard the reason as to why he was behind Jani Dushman? Basically, they were paying him per day and he said, fine, the more days I work, the more money I get.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, Akshay Kumar has made no bones about the fact that he's in it for the money. Like, yeah, fuck the activity, legacy and all. Paisa toh mere ko
done. Yeah, exactly.
Also, just a small this thing before we go to the next segment. Like, you know, like, a lot of these MMORPG games also came out, which were sort of like, kind of Matrix inspired in the sense, like your Second Life, where you were playing an avatar in an online world, in a simulated world. You had World of Warcraft. Also kind of became big around that time, you know, like, yeah,
so people had very
a lot of games also
lives
where like people were living, so like a lot of, I think Second Life was pretty much inspired by that, the fact that you were living an online life where you would like log in.
It ties into that same human need, right, to escape the current reality, because
reality,
it is some baseline level of shit and you want some utopia that you can build,
because people were paying money to play a character of themselves online where they were like,
this is bizarre,
right? I mean, but
yeah.
But when you think about it, you play video games also, which kind of cater to that fantasy as well.
Right? For sure. Like, imagine you're Kratos, where you're like mowing down people.
You can't like one character. I would suggest like maybe Cyberpunk, I believe, where like you can characterize your character so well detailed and then you play. So yeah, like, I mean, there's so much this thing happening. Or any of these big games like Mass Effect and all, you create your own character.
Mass Effect, you have Grand Theft Auto 5, which has basically been running for 10 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a world, that world just, especially the online world, just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger.
And bigger, yeah.
People have just, and MMORPGs, people have met their wives and their husbands on there. So it's a full-fledged existing ecosystem that has all come off the back of escaping your current grind.
Like I said, this movie predicts a lot of things that are commonplace in our life today. So in that sense,
yes.
It was almost, it was like soothsayer type, the movie. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I think that covers most of the themes that we wanted to discuss. Now on to the last and fun section. For our last section, which is what if X were to do Y, which for those of you who are tuning in for the first time, is a section where we try and hypothesize, usually with the help of ChatGPT, that if a certain other director were to make the movie that we're discussing today, what would that look like, right? So for today's movie, which Matrix, as we know, is a futuristic cyberpunk, very brooding, dark and black movie, we want to take a crack at imagining how it would look if Wes Anderson were to direct it. So firstly, I think the cast changes completely. You definitely have Bill Murray played Morpheus.
Morpheus, yeah. Like, I feel like we haven't spoken about, none of us have ever spoken about this film or like this whole idea, and instantly all of us wait for Bill Murray as Morpheus.
Has to be. Who play? I think William Dafoe plays Smith. Which he could do even in this Matrix, in the original version, right?
It would be such a bizarre, like, you know, Willem Dafoe is very intense, dude. Like,
yeah.
Okay, so, okay, before we all say who's Neo, let's all take a breath and go and count to three and let's try and say it together, yeah? One,
three, two,
one.
Owen Wilson.
Owen Wilson.
Owen Wilson. Wow. Instead of wow.
Yeah. The Matrix.
Okay. Oh man, yeah. Owen Wilson is Neo, Bill Murray as Morpheus, and you have
already whitewashed this film.
Who plays Carrie and Moss? Yeah, you already whitewashed this film. Hey, Wes Anderson. Oh yeah, actually, other than Jeffrey Wright, he doesn't use many people of color, if you've noticed.
Carrie and Moss, I think for me,
who,
still
who plays?
Definitely.
Fraternal Trinity.
But just think about it.
Right? And does the story change? Because
the story doesn't.
The story change, is too hardcore for. I mean, it'll be, no. I would say
the story is very
seriousness.
Like,
yeah.
Underground
yeah.
world,
yeah.
The real world will look very
shit.
Colorful.
Yeah.
Sentinels will look very.
And it'll be some quirky shit. It's like, you know, I want to open a bakery.
You'll have the 2D style animation of them running away from the Sentinels. In a way, like,
yeah.
And then they'll be running in there and they'll be like the Sentinels chasing them.
And even the whole, we need guns, lots of guns. It'll just be, you know, those quick jump cuts of one gun, another
yeah,
gun,
yeah,
another
no.
gun.
Like, you have a narrative there for.
Yes.
What if for me?
No, I was going to say, what if Tarantino made the Matrix?
There'd be like these guards talking about some random bizarre trivia. Like a virgin. And then they'll be like,
and then suddenly heads explode.
And suddenly they're like, and then a guy will walk through the thing and be like, got any guns? And then the scene starts.
So it'll be non-linear. So the ending will be shown first, then somewhere
yeah,
in the middle will be shown there. Like it was super non-linear.
Bro,
which will
I don't think
the
this concept, can
concept of the
world. Yeah.
Only
this
here
concept is very complicated
non-linear.
To begin with. This plus
non-linear,
nobody will understand. Yeah.
Also, the soundtrack would have been very different. Like what these guys went for,
oh,
like
I
the
imagine,
sort of
yeah,
music.
We didn't
I need to talk. Yeah, we need to spend time on soundtrack. And the moment it should have been in the memorable moment section, is the ending of the movie
that
where he's in the phone booth and he walks
yes,
out and
when
flies.
He flies out, no?
Yeah, and I think as he flies,
and they play,
he introduces a generation
Rage
of
the machine.
Rage Against the Machine, yeah. So Rage Against the Machine closes this. Now, if you aren't, I don't know, if you've lived under a rock, if you're not like a big rap metal fan, Rage Against the Machine is one of the definitive fucking bands of the 90s, yeah? We probably didn't got
yeah.
to it much later because we were too young. But 92 was when they released
oh,
their album,
yeah.
and that came off the back of the Rodney King killings. And they've always been against what, anti-establishment. They're an anti-establishment band, right? Even though I think at Boston Calling 2 years
yeah.
ago, the price was it was $500 a ticket to go see them. And so I was like, oh, they are definitely the machine now. There's no more rage left. So. So the soundtrack of this film, I think the propellers, the sequence with in the lobby, which you keep coming back to, which is like this weird take on the Bond film, Bond theme. Then you have the Prodigy soundtrack. You have
the
really eclectic bunch of people.
Again, it's very industrial rock.
Industrial, yeah, rock,
yeah.
yeah. And then metal.
It's very Trent Reznor, pre-Trent Reznor types, I would say.
They didn't have Rob Zombie also, dude.
Yeah, there's a Rob Zombie. I think there's a thing from Dracula. Yeah, yeah, Dracula's.
There's a Rob Zombie soundtrack. Yeah, Dracula comes when they go to the club.
I love that song. I didn't know it was Rob Zombie. It's like,
yeah, and
for me,
that
is the peak Matrix sound when they're in the club. But yeah, I think Tarantino would have very different soundtrack. Wes Anderson would have a very different soundtrack.
Did you guys know that Duhas was in the Matrix? I don't remember.
Yes, yes.
Duhas
oh, yeah. Okay, that's another song I was supposed to bring up. Yes.
Where the fuck does it come in the movie?
I don't remember
Duhas in the movie.
I don't think it plays
in it. It was in the movie, but it was part of the soundtrack.
Part of the soundtrack.
Yeah, okay.
Duhas.
Speaking of industrial rock.
Yeah, I know. Like Rammstein is industrial.
And I remember Marilyn Manson's music video "Rock Is Dead." I think it incorporated like videos from the movie.
Yeah, even his whole aesthetic is very similar to the Matrix.
Similar to yeah, that whole like tight dress.
The lot of the body, sort of the legacy
of
the movie is far beyond
into fashion, culture, so many things. Like, it's crazy, bro. It's influenced so many people. Like.
Great staying power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But yeah, I think that was our take on The Matrix. Anything more anyone wants to add before we wrap it up?
I think that's about it. I feel like we've covered pretty much all bases. We've acknowledged this film as a standalone action film, and it should so be the only movie in this franchise that doesn't exist. That's how we will choose to look at it and be happy.
If you ever do any Matrix sequel, please call me also for that.
Oh, of course, yeah. I'll call you Power Up Agar Diwana.
The Reloaded. I feel is a, I mean, everybody thinks it's a hot take, but I would say it's more funny than Hera Ferry for me. Pradarshan movie? Is it a Pradarshan movie?
It's a hot take.
No, it's a Sajid Nadiwala film. No, it's
okay, yes.
He directed, yeah, Sajid Nadiwala directed.
It's directed by Vikram Bhatt, dude.
Quite the range, and he also liked
Kasoor. I really like Kasoor. I'm the only person in this world who likes Kasoor. But
I mean, it's very watchable because of Lisa Ray. So.
Yeah, basically.
And Raaz was basically a remake of What Lies Beneath. Correct. I remember that.
Yeah.
Harrison Ford.
I watched What Lies Beneath after I watched Raaz, and my God, Raaz.
Yeah, I mean, Vikram Bhatt is not known for his originality.
Diwaniya Vaipalli also he directed. Which was based on this something about Mary. Correct.
We'll call you for the Avara Pagal Diwana episode as well.
Death Boat. I'll show you why it's better than Hera Ferry.
We'll have the conversation then. Anyway, that's all for this week's episode.
That's us.
We'll see you soon.
Thank you for
Take care.